Hello. First, a big thank you to Paul for inviting me down to O'Neill. I'm really honored to be here. Thank you so much for the introduction. I'm going to start with a few poems that are kind of more about family. One of the things that I've kind of been trying to explore is how sort of fragments of our members of our family kind of become parts of our own lives, even though we weren't there and don't really know what we're talking about. But they still, these sort of family myths kind of become part of your own heritage. So you find yourself in conversations talking about, you know, the fact that my granny used to, in the States, used to play piano. She was a very accomplished piano player. But for some reason it bothered my granddad, so she always played in the basement. She never played publicly, it was just something that she did. And so it was never really spoken about, but supposedly she was very accomplished. I never got the opportunity to hear her play anything. This poem is about that small myth being a part of my life. It's called She Remembers Childhood. I'm talking about my mother remembering her. Framed by the oval mirror on the table, her face searching for some decay, evidence that she is becoming her mother. Eyes are china cup nerves. I am a fly on the ceiling as she looks backward. Each cup rested on the undesired nature of parenthood. A Sunday coffee in the kitchen, Wellesley, Massachusetts. Followed by silence and chatter as piano drifts from the basement. The weight of unhappiness created by the distance from others. They were the first Catholic family in the neighborhood. Fears are mixed with the desire to return to another time, her and her father on a boat fishing in the Atlantic. These are the stories that billow each morning after dreams. And kind of moving on from that theme, my grandfather on my dad's side was in the Navy during the First World War. That tells you how old my dad was. And he was a lot luckier than his two brothers who were Army. And they obviously came back with terrible injuries after the First World War. But the family myth about him is that his ship was in the back of Jutland and he slept the whole way through it. So this is, you did not stir in North Sea. For a grandfather in the First World War. All I know of you are photographs, a likeness faded in spring light. Your boyish lips leave little room for terror that followed you throughout your life. A set of photographs with your brothers, one taken before the war, one after the war. The other, in uniform, were smiles, feigned forgetfulness. The Navy was more kind to you, no leg severed above the knee. In the battle for the sea you slept, etherized in the destroyer's cradle. I possess the same gift, to sleep through voices from the kitchen and the rattle of the wind. Part of the introduction was saying that I've been in these anthologies with a collaborative group called Beautiful Dragons Press. Now, each poet is assigned a task, and the two anthologies I've included in, first of which was about elements. So we all pick elements from the periodic table. I didn't get an element. They ran out of elements by the time I got involved. So I got fire as a kind of, fire, water, earth, etc. I was kind of disappointed. I wanted some random, like, atomic, nuclear, like, or plutonium or something you can really kind of confuse yourself with. But I got fire. And so this is my attempt at describing fire. Fire. Its gift is to kindle the elements, and for all its sign or ceremony, fire is judged by its purpose. To change the structure of things, so we cannot go back. The work of the chandler is to balance the wax and the wick, so people across from one another can see without too bright a light. Though their breath may surfeit the flame, red wine, palms folded together, are friends, These consistencies are as they appear, the seemingly infinite rotations of our lives shared. So I'm moving away from the sort of family to sort of personal elements. Oh, wait, I'm not. No, I'm back. It's right there. This poem is called Infantes, or like the idea of Latin to be, so to be a child. And it's kind of, again, working on like fractured memories of, like, when you're a small child, you don't understand that your parents have complex thoughts about they're reflecting on their own lives and you're just there, you know, and you're not really part of that yet because, you know, they can't have an intellectual conversation with you that you can understand. So, Infantes. White-tipped wings lap against me. Gulls cry mother from my lips. A trailing skirt held below the knee dips into cold steel water from the slope of the shore to the sea. A left hand red and ready grips some unknown life she had before me. Smoothed by water, sand forgets her steps through shores of drifting memory. The tide reverberates against the quay. I am chased into it by the ships balanced on the curve of the earth. I'm trying to be conscious of time as well, because I know that it's limited and important. So, on we go. This poem is called The Anchor and the Weight. I think when I first wrote it, it was like my favorite poem I had written, so I was like really proud of it. It has yet to be published anywhere, to my immense disappointment. So, I still like it, so it's really important. Okay, The Anchor and the Weight. The silence of your hands, I remember that. Like a child's arm stretched into her own foreground, or clasping the air like a sailor now overboard, drifting into the wild sleep of the sea. Hold me up and above the wreck of your mouth, covered when you yawn, or held close before you were submerged in the completeness of the ocean. If we were to drift together, it would only be until in the tide or current, or by some other force that we can no longer see or feel, we are divided. This poem, I would like to request your patience. It's the longest poem I've written, which isn't actually that long, so don't start panicking. But it's called Turning Point, and I wrote it after having this really strange walk around Armagh. There's this spherical sculpture. I found that it's called Turning Point, and I named my poem after this. Walking around the park, you know, you're hanging out with someone, you don't know really what to do. It's, you don't really know what to talk about, you don't know each other that well, but you're kind of stuck in this sort of socializing, but just the two of you kind of walking around. So this was an attempt at something that came from all the stuff that was going on in my head. Turning Point. I am seasick from the lonely fog, coming from the ocean and through me, suddenly against the man who cannot find the corner where he sleeps. My name crumbles under my fingers like dried paint on a leather boot. The sun comes out into this soupy weather, and the air is the steam from the daily canteen dinners that I regret to say taste of nothing, but I love them anyway. We all look for grave diggers in high places. I wear my shovel shoes, coming into a world I forget the morning I saw her dressed with everything left to the imagination. I took her to the park, and it scattered moments of death and leaves. The paved ways here are instruction manuals from the dishwasher where I rest old light bulbs for the romantic encounter we are not having. So I take step one after step two and forget the detergent altogether because I took her elbow, not her hand. I wish I told her about the woman speaking to another woman. I thought she was her mother. I listened to find them. They were beautiful, but I did not understand their words, which could sound like anything. Failing this, I helped a woman place a bunch of rotten grapes into the bin. My mind strolls back to the park, and we admire the library of inconstant stars carved on a globe where we place our eyes into its dark, impressive bodies. I look for something I can recognize, but it's bronze. Our conversation on elocution is stunted, but I don't mind it so. The clouds come and make her skin just another wet surface. The rainfall fails to draw the soldier statues out of the rain, and under the yew tree, surrounded by granite, how I am disappointed. How am I doing for time? What? I'm going to read another poem from one of the anthologies I was included in with the Beautiful Dragons, and this poem, or the anthology is called Not a Drop, and in this one all the poets who contributed had to pick a C. So it's categorized in the book that this is in the Atlantic Ocean. It's not, it's actually near the Mediterranean. It's between the Mediterranean and the Black Sea? Black Sea, my geography's terrible. But I chose the Sea of Marmara. And one of the reasons I chose the Sea of Marmara is with, it's really, like the Propontis in ancient Greek is like the border between Asia Minor and Europe. It's like, it's sort of the most contested space between sort of the Middle East and Europe. It always has been. It's been a scene for escape and loss and adventure all kind of at the same time. It's kind of an odd, isolated scene. It seems more like a giant lake than anything else. But this is my kind of quite wild. Actually, I'll speak a bit more about it because it's addressed to Peter Singer. And Peter Singer has a sort of philosophical paper on our responsibility in relation to our distance to something that's negative. So you see, his example is a child is drowning in a sort of small pond. And are you obliged to help? If there's no risk for you to be, you know, you're not going to be drowned. You're an adult. You're perfectly capable of wading in and inside of water with no harm to yourself. And so he goes on to sort of describe how, in many ways, the suffering of other people in distant places is just as easily solved by our actions. So we kind of created sort of an innocence by our distance when we're actually, because we have the ability to help, we should. So to kind of escape the, it's like, oh, well, that thing's happening somewhere far away. I'm not responsible because I couldn't possibly affect it, but the reality is we can all affect it in small ways. And the reason it doesn't actually get better is none of us take responsibility and make the small actions towards actually making the situation better. Because we're constantly kind of given narratives of the one person, the kind of the hero character who's supposed to solve the problem. Well, most human problems are actually solved by lots of individuals doing tiny little bits of work. Like, that's how big corporations are able to do what they do, is because that's exactly how they function. They, you know, put out very complicated tasks to hundreds of thousands of people, and they're achieved quite seamlessly. But when it comes to achieving good in the world, we like to create that distance again, because we're far away from the problem. And our own contribution is seemingly insignificant when it's not. So now, to the poem. Marmara, to Peter Singer. Where the bridge of water pinched between the Bosphorus and the narrow crossing at the Dardanelles, contours outline stories of escape, like lines traced by a finger on a window. As black mirror through across black mirrors, I see bodies rise or lay limp in the backwash from drowning. My distance from them is an imaginarium where innocence is constructed. At home, watching swimmers shift among the waves as gull feathers do, I cast stones to skim the surface, to escape gravity, if only for a moment. A hand curled into words reserved for amnesty. I know murder is just as close as an outstretched arm or the whip of a wrist. I'm going to read two more poems and that'll be it. This one is called Physic. It's sort of like how one could write a love poem to a surgeon. The smallest scar is your profession's perfection. A sliver of flesh is presented between two strips of surgical blue paper. Under a perfect light. I never saw your home or the hospital where you work, so I imagine and already know as I fold the key against the lock, I love you and forget how you watch the edge of your blade sink into soft bodies. A patient face hidden from your explorations into the abdomen, from the incision, the blood that rushes under the crust of skin overflows. I was too drunk at the time to be concerned, but I remember your nail gliding along my own scar and your smile. Okay, this is my last poem. It's kind of coming back to how I started. It's a poem for my father. When I was 11, he had a brain hemorrhage, and for about 16 months, he was essentially paralyzed, and most of his brain function had gone at that stage. There'd be times it'd be very strange where, you know, he wouldn't be able to talk or move or, you know, feed himself or anything. And you kind of forget that there's a full person inside with like a personality that is the person who raised you. And we used to do things to try to simulate that. Like one of the ones who was in the hospital, we'd ring the phone. And kind of like as an autopilot, you'd pick up the phone and go hello. And sort of try to talk and go through the motions of speaking on the phone. But it wasn't there, like it would just sort of dissipate after a while. And it's weird to see that sort of entropy of the human being. So I kind of struggled for a long time to try to write about it in a way that sort of made sense. This is about kind of dealing with the long term afterwards. So it's simply called For James Simmons. I dream steady now, and where I am led, I find you adrift in an old garden chair. Your face is a memory of words you said. You repeat lines from a book I've read. Like my own eyes, they are so familiar. I dream steady now, and where I am led is the small pond beside the flower bed, and for some reason I love it there. Your face is a memory of words, you say. Then I see the pale wound on your head. I extend my hand slowly as if it were a dare. I dream steady now, and where I am led is the moment I remember you are dead. As I face you, I am fixed in a stare. Your face is a memory of words you said. You repeat lines from a book I've read. While I am asleep in a wicker chair, I dream steady now, and where I am led, your face is a memory of words you said. Thank you.